Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. You know about Donald Trump's really bad week, followed by really bad poll numbers after he made Kaiser Khan, Paul Ryan, John McCain, and Kelly Ayotte his enemies. He sank so badly, he's even 4 points behind in Georgia. Georgia, in that state's new poll. That's how erratic his behavior now seems. This Trump supporter from Pennsylvania on ABC This Week reflected it when asked if he could trust his candidate with the nuclear codes.
I don't know. No, I don't know. He's a little... I guess I do. I mean, he's not that stupid that he would just send something off without thinking about it, I think. I don't know.
This week's poll is in a nutshell, right in that soundbite. And you know about Hillary Clinton lying to the public about lying to the public about lying to the public.
I have said during the interview and in many other occasions over the past months that what I told the FBI, which he said was truthful, is consistent with what I have said publicly. So I may have short-circuited it, and for that I will try to clarify.
She repeatedly said there was no classified information on her private email server, which the FBI director then said there was, which Clinton said he said there wasn't. And then she said she didn't really mean to say that, but said it again on Friday in that clip. Lying about lying about lying. From the Avoid False Equivalencies desk, that little bit of weaseliness does not mean she's so bizarre she can't be trusted with the nuclear codes. That's true in almost anyone's opinion, unlike with Trump, that from the Avoid False Equivalencies desk, just saying. But you probably know about those stories already, and maybe ad nauseum. What you may not know about might actually be the biggest national politics story of the past week. A Tea Party stalwart, Congressman Tim Huelskamp, lost his Republican primary in Kansas. Tim Huelskamp is this guy.
We have 40 members of the House Freedom Caucus. I would estimate perhaps 10 other conservatives, up to 10, that frankly will not support Kevin McCarthy for Speaker. But you put the math together, it's pretty clear. Kevin McCarthy does not have 218 votes to be Speaker today.
This time, it wasn't an establishment politician getting successfully primaried by the Tea Party. For the first time, it was the other way around. And Molly Ball, national political correspondent for The Atlantic, writes that this is an indication that if Trump becomes president, for all his anti-establishment fury, he would have an increasingly establishment Congress at his back. So let's start there. Hi, Molly. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much.
Who is Tim Huelskamp, and what did he represent in Congress?
Well, Huelskamp was one of the leaders of, as you heard in that clip, the Freedom Caucus, formerly known as the Tea Party. He was one of these right-wing members of Congress who was a constant thorn in the side of Republican leadership, starting with John Boehner. In fact, helped to force out John Boehner. It's amazing to think, but that was less than a year ago now. And then Paul Ryan, too. I mean, while we've all been paying attention to Trump, Paul Ryan has had an exceedingly hard time running the House of Representatives. Because it just structurally, it's almost an impossible job given the divides within the Republican caucus. So before Trump came along, there was this Republican Civil War dynamic that's kind of different from what we have today. But you know, the Tea Party versus the establishment, the heck no caucus, you might call it, that just didn't want to pass anything or didn't see anything as pure and conservative enough. Often backed by right wing pressure groups like the Heritage Foundation and the Club for Growth that scored all these votes and pushed members to vote against a lot of traditional bipartisan legislation like basic spending bills to keep the government open and the farm bill, things like the Export-Import Bank, which was important to the business community, the Chamber of Commerce, but opposed by ideological conservatives who saw it as sort of corporate welfare. So Huelskamp was a real sort of avatar of that faction in the House. and the establishment decided it was going to gang up and defeat him, actually recruited a candidate who'd never run for office before just to take on Huelskamp in the Republican primary, and ended up routing him, winning by double digits, a really resounding defeat for this Tea Party member in Kansas.
To give our listeners a little more of a sense of what kind of Tea Party Republican or Freedom Caucus Republican just got defeated, here's a little bit more of Tim Huelskamp. This is a minute of him at a speech to the group Right Online in 2011.
And I agree. There are two Americas. There's them and us. Do you agree with that? There are two Americas out there. There's what they kind of call now the Chicago elite, the Chicago mob, whatever you call it, and the rest of us, you know, the insiders versus the outsiders, the Beltway versus the real world. And I'm sitting on the floor of the U.S. House, kind of the first big debate on the budget, and I'm sitting there listening to the leftists, and in this case, they're all in the same party, and they were talking, and I turned to one of the guys, the Republicans, been around a while, and I said, Bob, do they really believe what they're saying, or are they just lying? Or they really believe what they just say? He said, quick answer, he said, they really believe what they're saying. And of course they lie, as we found out with Mr. Weiner. But if you listen closely, just a few months, Washington seems like, to me, a horror film entitled Liberals Unplugged.
All right, so that guy, Tim Huelskamp, now defeated by a more establishment Republican in his primary last week. So, Molly, I guess salient to the national conversation and why we're talking about this one Kansas district on a New York radio show, do we consider Huelskamp a representative of the Trump wing of the party, now defeated, or something else?
I think it's something else. I really think Trump is sort of perpendicular to the old fault lines of the Republican Civil War, because even as Donald Trump has been winning, or has won, obviously, the Republican nomination, the Republican presidential primary this year, all of the incumbent and establishment-aligned politicians have been winning their primaries. So Huelskamp was an incumbent who lost, but he was a Tea Party incumbent. The establishment candidate won the Senate primary in Indiana up against a more sort of Ted Cruz-type right-wing congressman who was also seeking the nomination. There was an establishment senator in Alabama, to give another example, who also had a challenger who got almost no traction. So even as Trump has been winning on this outsider platform, the outsiders have not been having any success in down-ballot races. And in fact, a lot of groups that have been polling on these primaries have told me that Trump's success was correlated with the success of the establishment candidates, because a lot of people saw them as having in common the desire to get things done. And they're tired of the gridlock, they're tired of the obstruction and the rebelliousness of the Ted Cruz wing of the party that wanted to shut down the government and not get things done. So I think that Trump won the Republican primary by taking from both factions, the Tea Party and the establishment, in sort of a unique way. But that old conflict is still brewing. And the Chamber of Commerce and the Farm Bureau, which really is the agribusiness industry, the people who were against Huelskamp in this primary, they want him to serve as an example. They want the other members of the Freedom Caucus to look at this and say, you better tone it down or this could happen to you, in the same way that all of the establishment and moderate Republicans have had the crap scared out of them for years by the potential for a right-wing primary challenge. They're trying to invert that dynamic.
Right. And so when you talk about the Farm Bill as emblematic of this, our listeners may think, oh, I live in New York City or near New York City. What do I care about the Farm Bill? But that's really an urban and rural coalition law, which gives farmers government subsidies while also ensuring that there's money for food stamps. And the Tea Party Freedom Caucus wing was against that. Do you know if Trump has taken the position on a position on the Farm Bill, which might reveal his position on food stamps?
That's a really interesting question, and I do not know. I have no idea. I think it seems likely that he might have been asked about it in one of these rural states primaries if he did an interview with the local media. But I don't know the answer to that. But as you, the farm bill, as you mentioned, is interesting because not only is there a bipartisan coalition for it, right? As you mentioned, the Democrats representing urban districts that where a lot of people depend on food stamps, and the Republicans representing rural districts where farmers depend on those subsidies. Although farmers also are in favor of food stamps because it's so much of their market, people can buy farm products because they get food stamps. But there's also a bipartisan coalition against it. The environmentalists hate it. They hate the way it subsidizes agribusiness and corporate farming and all the non-sustainable agricultural practices that they despise. And so you have this interesting coalition of, you know, the Heritage Foundation and the environmentalists who are both opposed to the farm bill. And I wrote about it a few years ago as emblematic of the divide within the Republican Party because rural voters, who are overwhelmingly older and white, are the bedrock of the Republican Party's support in this day and age. They are the most likely sort of voter bloc to vote Republican, but they're increasingly sort of alienated by this this Republican or conservative, I should say, perspective on things like the farm bill that says, well, this is just, you know, corporate welfare. It's too much government spending. It's hundreds of billions of dollars. And encouraging Republicans to vote against this legislation that a lot of people in rural areas depend on. So it's sort of a question of what does the Republican Party stand for? Is it about ideological conservatism and reducing government spending by any means necessary, or is it about spending government money but on their people?
Yeah. So one more thing about this before we get back to Trump versus Clinton per se. You wrote that Trump is a disruption of the previous party conflict. Do you mean by that that in the Republican establishment versus Tea Party caucus fight, Trump is neither, and that by setting his own new Republican America First agenda, he disrupts that whole storyline that we've been watching for the last 5 years or whatever, Boehner versus the Tea Party versus Obamacare, et cetera?
Yes, I think that's true. Now, the question is this a long-term disruption or an anomaly? I think what I've learned from the Trump candidacy is that the Tea Party was never totally about conservative principles. It was sort of a coalition of ideological conservatives and what I call resentment voters. And Trump took the resentment voters, but not the ideological conservatives, which is why you've seen a lot of erstwhile leaders of the Tea Party who oppose Trump. So the question is, can anybody else do that? And that's why I'm really looking with a lot of interest at Paul Ryan's primary in Wisconsin tomorrow, which he is expected to win easily, but he's running against a candidate who's really styled himself as a mini Trump, taking a lot of Trump's positions, criticizing Ryan on immigration, on trade, decrying globalism, trying to strike that Trumpian populist note instead of the more traditional anti-establishment note. And I don't think he's going to win, but it'll be interesting to see how much appeal he's able to get in Paul Ryan's district with that kind of message.
Yeah, although I saw an excruciating interview with him on CNN the other night by Don Lemon, where he wouldn't say, even as the Trumpy candidate running against Paul Ryan on the week where Trump famously would not endorse Paul Ryan for re-election, this guy would not answer the question as to whether he wanted Trump's endorsement himself. And I thought that really reflected the difficult position that any Republican candidate is in this year, even if they're trying to align themselves with Trump's views, because Trump is becoming so unpopular.
That's very interesting. Yeah.
So, for what it's worth. Molly Ball, national political reporter for The Atlantic, my guest here on WNYC, and we can take your national politics calls for her at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And let's get back to the presidential race per se. The Clinton lie about a lie about a lie. I mean, hardly anybody understands what she lied about, so it's a mush, and that probably helps her. But the impression of her as a liar gets reinforced. Will you take a crack at unpacking what she said that FBI Director Comey contradicted?
Well, I think, as you said, she's misrepresenting the statements of the FBI director, which were very hard on her at the same time as he was announcing that she was not going to be indicted. I think as you said, the takeaway from this is that people still do have people's willingness to trust Hillary Clinton has not been increased by this whole affair, as the media continues to point out that she is not able to be honest about this, and that it and that she seems so incredibly defensive about it. You heard there was that moment when she was speaking where it sounded like she was about to say she apologized, and then she didn't. She said she would try to clarify.
Mm-hmm.
So she's not able to accept any responsibility for the actions that she took here. I think every time this comes up, it continues to hurt her credibility. What you see in a lot of the polling, even as Trump has fallen pretty far behind, there's still a lot of voters. Both candidates tend to be under 50 in a lot of these polls because there's a lot of voters who can't bring themselves to pick either of the two candidates. So even if they're turned off by Trump, I think this kind of thing makes it hard for people who might otherwise be willing to vote against Trump to commit to the Democratic candidate.
What Comey said, I believe, is that Clinton did not lie in her interview with the FBI, so she did not commit perjury. But he pretty much suggested, though without quite saying it, that she lied to the public in the political context when she said there were no classified emails on her private server. Because he said there were a few classified emails on her public server, just a few, and there was a bunch of other information that she in her position should have realized was information that should have been classified. So when she just goes out and simply says, well, there was no information that was classified on my server or that I would have known was classified on my server, that's the lie, right?
Yes, that's a correct description of the situation. And she seems to believe that she was just shorthanding it, right? That when she claimed that he had vindicated her, she was referring to what he said about her interview, and that therefore her public statements could be considered vindicated, which doesn't follow. And I think also to suggest that she was, you know, merely shortcutting the way she described that is disingenuous, and also somewhat memorable, right, as sort of a gaffe to say, oh, I must have short-circuited. And you see people seizing on that suggest that she's not aware of the situation.
Right. And the Trump people even put out one of their few ads showing Hillary Clinton saying that, and then there's this, like, electricity glow in the screenshot of her, like, short-circuiting, like, bzzz, like her brain is not all there. And others who are her opponents and critics are saying, oh, short-circuited means, like, oh, I had a brain cramp, and that's why I lied to you, American people. I think she meant short-circuited in the way that you just described it, she was taking a shortcut and giving a very short-form answer in a fast back-and-forth with Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday last week. And that's how she was trying to get out of it. I don't think that's exactly accurate either. But how do you, as a political reporter, guard against false equivalencies this year? The Times has a front page story about this today. I don't know if you saw it yet. If Clinton lies about something like that, but is not a real threat to basic national security, like former CIA Director Mike Morrell says Trump is, are you on the lookout against saying, well, he had a bad week and she had a bad week, and leave it like that, suggesting they're equally bad, when objective reality may lead you in another direction, a less equivalent direction?
I get a little annoyed by this criticism because I think it has become a sort of meme that liberals in particular leap to discredit any criticism of Democratic candidates. It is always possible to compare two candidates without declaring them to be equivalent. It is possible for two candidates both to have bad weeks without them being equally bad weeks. And I don't think it's ever illegitimate to put the two candidates in a two-party system where two people are on the ballot side by side, compare them to one another, and you are not suggesting that they are equivalent by comparing them. I think this has become just a sort of knee-jerk thing on the part of partisans who don't want to accept any equivalent, any criticism of their candidate, or want the media to come out on their side and say their candidate is better than the other, which is not our job as the media. I think what you see in the polls is that voters find the candidates untrustworthy in interestingly different ways. The distrust of Donald Trump seems, as you described, to be focused mainly on his temperament, whereas with Hillary Clinton, it seems to be much more about her honesty and transparency, which suggests to me that the media has done a good job on the level of details and nuance of describing the candidate's different sins against the truth and giving voters an accurate picture of their respective temperaments.
Ed on Staten Island, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Brian. Great guest. This primarily speaks to the opening where you had someone speak about Donald Trump and nuclear weapons. The simple question that I have is, has anybody asked Hillary Clinton what her views are on nuclear weapons? Because it really would seem to me to be something that I wouldn't expect a presidential candidate or even a president to say that they would never use nuclear weapons. Obviously, it's been something that there's always been the intent that the fear for your enemy is that you would use it. So the question is, has anybody ever asked her?
Molly, do you know the answer to that question? But I would suggest that the discussion about Trump having his finger on the nuclear codes as compared to Hillary Clinton is not really about their policy per se. You know, under what circumstances would you actually use nuclear weapons and consider that a legitimate use of government force, as opposed to saying Trump is so erratic and does things out of vindictiveness and pettiness, and he's a guy you can bait with a tweet, as Hillary herself put it in her speech. And people are afraid that, you know, he's just too erratic to run the government. He's too erratic to run the military, not even necessarily that he would actually launch a nuclear attack. So that's really what this discussion is about. But then again, they would also have specific positions on nuclear weapons.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I'm not intimately familiar with Hillary Clinton's specific positions on the use of nuclear weapons. I would guess that it is sort of in the mainstream of conventional foreign policy thinking, which holds that nuclear arsenals are useful and intended primarily as a deterrent. But I do think, yes, exactly as you said, most of the time when you hear people making this criticism of Trump, it's about the idea that some foreign leader might, you know, say something negative about him in an interview or tweet at him or get under his skin in some way, and he would sort of fly off the handle, that because his behavior tends to be not particularly consistent or controlled, that he would sort of do something rash. And so it's not even necessarily about nukes, although it is about nukes because of the incredible danger and irrevocability of that decision, right, and the way it's concentrated in the executive. Foreign policy and nuclear weapons decisions are one of the few things that a president gets to do all by himself, and so there is no check on him from Congress or from any of the other branches,
right,
of government.
Plus, he gave the kind of scary answer in an interview last week. He said, well, why do we have them if we're not going to use them?
Right. That is not the kind of thing I think most people in the foreign policy establishment are used to hearing.
Just on that point, before we're out of time, there was the Mike Morrell statement on Trump as a national security threat to tie this up. Now, Mike Morrell is not a household name, but he's a pretty tough former CIA director who served Democratic and Republican administrations, who was hard on Obama in his recent book. Mm-hmm. He was on the show, among many other places, being hard on Obama as former head of the CIA, saying he's going to support Clinton now because Trump is a national security threat. That's how erratic he is.
Right. And you've heard this from a lot of these types of national security and foreign policy elites who are not traditionally particularly partisan or even have been Republicans. A lot of the national security conservatives have come out and said that they are against Trump or even will vote for Hillary Clinton because of these kinds of concerns about Trump and because I think of the concentration of executive power in matters of foreign policy, national security, and defense. These people seem more prone to view Trump as an active danger than perhaps other factions of the party of the right.
Molly Ball, national political correspondent for The Atlantic. Thanks a lot, Molly.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, Bill Bradley, and Tom Kaine together. Next, stay with us.